Thank you. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to start with a few remarks on a topic that has already been discussed here the past 2 days, and that will be again discussed by a panel tomorrow morning. And it has to do with the issue or controversy or connection between fundamental or basic and applied physics. Since I'm not a member of that panel, I'll get in my 2 bits worth on this subject right now. I should begin by mentioning that the original nomenclature during the 1930s and 40s was between pure and applied physics. And by implication, applied was less pure or maybe even impure. I believe that this hierarchy of increasing lack of purity is damaging to science. It would start with pure mathematics, and then theoretical physics was applied math, chemistry applied physics, biology applied chemistry, and medicine applied biology. To alleviate the situation a little bit, the United States agencies now talk about curiosity-driven or goal-oriented research. But it is not a matter of either or. Sometimes the two are the same. And I give a very good example of the Nobel Prize for Bose-Einstein condensation when Kettle, Cornell, and Wieman got this a couple of years ago. Their goal was, of course, to create a Bose-Einstein condensate, but this was also their curiosity. And I'd like to illustrate it with two happenings in my own scientific activity. In the first one, the curiosity-driven or pure physics was first, and then came the applications, and in the second case, it was just the other way around. I was a first graduate student of Professor Ed Purcell, who got the Nobel Prize and shared it with Felix Bloch in 1952 for nuclear magnetic resonance. And he and I and Bob Pound wrote a paper on nuclear magnetic relaxation in 1948, which is still referred to as BPP. And in 1948, Professor Purcell went on public record and he said, this is no applications for NMR. No applications for NMR. It is a very weak kind of magnetism and it's a pure academic pursuit. And I agreed with him at that time. We didn't have the insight of Felix Bloch, who took out patent and so on for the applications. But then, a few years later, NMR was used by the chemists to determine the structure of all kinds of chemical molecules, and this activity still persists today. NMR is used to elucidate the very complicated structure of proteins and of enzymes. It's a very sophisticated and large-scale application of NMR, but of course the chemists consider that as basic research, which they are certainly entitled to do. And then in the 60s, neither Purcell nor I, nor anybody else in NMR, had the foresight to think about MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, which is now becoming almost as important as X-ray diagnostics in the field of medicine. And of course, MRI was recognized by the Nobel Prize in Medicine last year. So, from my point of view, this is a clear example where basic curiosity-driven research on physical mechanisms of nuclear magnetic relaxation preceded the applications. But now, let me go about 8 years further in 1956, when just the opposite happened. At that time, there were many laboratories, both industrial and academic, who wanted to construct a new type of very low noise microwave amplifier. And I hit upon the idea to introduce a pumping scheme because I was familiar with magnetic saturation and with magnetic relaxation effects. And I said, let's apply a saturation on a transition between two non-adjacent energy levels. And then look what happens at a transition from an intermediate energy level. And in one of those transitions, you are likely to get stimulated emission, dominating absorption, and you could construct a maser amplifier that way. And in fact, these solid-state masers, based on this idea, had immediate applications. They were used in radar receiving antennas for transatlantic microwave communication between the United States and Western Europe. They were used in the DEW line, the distant early warning radar spread along the Arctic Circle in Canada and Alaska to look for possible incoming missiles from the Soviet Union. And last but not least, they were used by Penzias and Wilson to detect the 3-degree microwave cosmic background radiation. Now, here we have a clear example that the goal, a low-noise microwave amplifier, preceded the science. Keep in mind that this distinction between the two is not very useful, but only if you have to apply for money. Follow your curiosity, but present it to the funding agency as goal-oriented. It is a curious historic fact that the crystal used mostly in these microwave masers was also the same material used in the first laser. And the first laser used a very similar pumping scheme to get laser action. And if I may have the first slide, I'm probably the oldest one here, and so I still have slides, which nobody else uses anymore. And here you see the Maiman Ruby laser, a very simple instrument. There is this photographic xenon-filled flash tube that provides the pumping radiation in the blue and the green. Ruby, of course, has its red color because it strongly absorbs blue and green. And then there is a relaxation mechanism, which you don't see, but after that pumping, the chromium ions in the ruby fall down to a fluorescent level, A and 2E levels, and from there you get so much stimulated emission that most of the energy stored in the chromium ions comes out as a narrow ray defined by the normal to the mirrors at the end faces. And this ruby laser puts out about 1 joule of light, has a volume of about 1 cubic centimeter. Now, a joule is a very small amount of light. A 100-watt bulb uses 100 joules every second. So we really don't talk too much high energy, but this energy comes out in a short time, and it can be focused in space. And the next slide shows you what happens then. Here you have a lens, and you produce a spark in the atmosphere. This was done by Dr. Terhoon at Ford Motor Company in Dearborn, Michigan, and he said, this is the most expensive spark plug in automotive history. Now, clearly, this lasers used as spark plugs is not very economical, but it shows you the power that is contained in this pulse of electromagnetic radiation. Now, the next slide shows you that in those early days, those lasers pulses were measured in terms of the unit of a Gillette. And here you say, wow, 5 Gillettes. The ruby laser pulse drilled holes in 5 Gillette blades. The next slide shows you what excited the military and the people in the newspapers. The incredible laser, which was going to be used in Star Wars concepts and death rays. And you would shine a powerful laser light traveling at the speed of light to any incoming hostile objects. But then Art Shalov, my colleague, who is unfortunately deceased, added, for credible lasers, see inside, and this he put on the door of his laboratory in Stanford. And those were the lasers I showed in the previous slide. And in fact, this application of lasers, which was also promulgated in the movies. 007 used a laser beam to cut into a safe or to kill somebody, is still far from reality. I served on a committee in 1962 in Washington, D.C., and there I learned at that time a classified information that with a laser pulse of 1,000,000 joules, you could disable an incoming intercontinental missile. And I did a high school calculation. I said 1 cubic centimeter can produce 1 joule of light, so a cubic meter can produce 1,000,000 joules. Very simple, very straightforward. Of course, a cubic meter of ruby would be hard to make, but there was already the neodymium glass laser. And clearly, a cubic meter of optical glass was clearly within the realm of technological possibilities. But the fact is that such large amounts of electromagnetic energy in the form of light, very hard to control, very hard to handle. And there is a building in Lawrence Livermore Lab, about as big as these halls we are in here, that produces 1,000,000 joules per shot. They can only give one shot every day or every week and cost a lot of money. But it is extremely hard to control these light intensities. And in fact, because of the properties of matter at high light intensity led to a new field of science, nonlinear optics, in which I took great interest for several decades. So originally, the funding by the military was very generous and continued to be generous because they foresaw possibilities, but the military applications were few and far between. And most of the laser work is now to the benefit of all civilians and for peaceful purposes. And let me illustrate that by a few examples. Next slide. Here you see a 30-year-old CW 5-kilowatt CO2 laser. The laser is here. These big things you see are just pumps to pump the gas around at very high speed to prevent the whole laser from burning up and to keep certain degrees of freedom in the gas cool. But the laser tubes are here, and you get 5 kilowatts of light. Nowadays, people use even 30 kilowatt CW continuous wave lasers in the shipbuilding industry to drill holes in heavy metal plates, to weld two plates together, to cut through plates, to et cetera, drill holes. In fact, lasers are used to drill holes in diamond. Now you might ask, why would anybody want to drill a hole in diamond? Very important for the wire drawing industry. Yeah, you know, you draw steel wires or other metal wires through a diamond hole to keep on going, producing miles and miles of wire. Next slide shows you an automotive system where the focus head can be used. And you can also use it to give heat treatment to the surface of workpieces. Next slide. And that you see here. The laser beam in the infrared comes in, and then there's a mirror which rotates, and you can move it up and down. You heat very briefly the surface element of your cylinder in your car engine. What happens, the laser beam melts that surface layer in a microsecond, very small thing, and then when the laser beam is passed away to another area, that molten material immediately solidifies very fast due to heat conduction into the wall. And so you can do surface hardening of any metal piece, any gear of complicated shape, and you keep the toughness of the material because you don't have this rapid heating and cooling in the main body of the cylinder wall or the gear piece of machinery. And that is what you want to prevent damage due to wear and tear. You want a very hard surface on a metal piece that is otherwise very tough. Lasers are ideal. Moving laser spots are ideal to achieve that. Next slide. Here you see this is a single crystal of titanium. And lo and behold, it's part of a blade of a jet engine. And the efficiency of jet engines is determined by the speed at which the top can rotate through the air, through the gases. And titanium is used because it remains very strong to very high temperature, about 2,000 degrees. But in order to improve the efficiency of a jet engine a little more, people here are drilling in holes near the tip of the blade to provide a little more cooling so the tip can move a little faster through the gas stream. And this 2% or 1% improvement in jet engine efficiency is economically important. And you drill holes at very sharp angles through a single crystal of titanium. Next slide. We go now from the high continuous power to lower power pulses. And here we do machining on a living object. This is a human hair. And you see, you can, with a laser, UV pulse laser, you can drill little holes in the in your hair. For what purpose? Absolutely useless. But it shows you the control laser pulses have, and you can make holes. You see, a human hair is about 30 micrometers across, and these are a few micrometer holes, and you can make them as deep as you want to. And in fact, although this is not used on hairs, these little ultraviolet pulses are used on your cornea to shape it so that you don't have to wear glasses, the so-called LASIK method. And it's computer controlled, and you take off half a micron here and 1 micron there from your cornea, and you can see better. Big medical application. The next slide shows you, of course, that you, through an optical fiber, through your arteries, you can even bring laser light inside your heart. And why would you want to drill a hole in your heart? Well, you don't want to drill a hole. But the people have used it to drill holes halfway through the heart muscle. Why? Because of this damage, your body then produces new blood vessels to restore the damage by these small incisions in your heart wall. And that improves the blood supply to your heart muscle. So people who have heart troubles have benefited from this light inside their heart chamber to make do a little damage, control damage, and subsequent recovery by more new blood vessels. I won't bother you with all the other medical applications that lasers now have in surgery, but I want to point out two things. A laser scalpel is sharper than the best surgical metal scalpel, because a laser beam can be focused to one wavelength of roughly, or even half a wavelength, and that is 1 micron. Now, the sharpest knife you can make has a knife edge of 10 microns, 10 times coarser. So you can make finer cuts with the laser beam. But besides that, the laser beam, if it cuts through a blood vessel, the blood absorbs the blue or green laser light. The both ends of the blood vessel you cut are automatically cauterized by the heat. And so laser surgery is much cleaner. You don't need sutures and you don't have any blood loss. You cut through the blood and both sides are automatically cauterized. So laser surgery is very widely used in many situations. So this was machining on living tissue. Next slide. We now go to even lower powers. This may be a little hard to see. Do see people see these little dots? They have a size of about 1 micron again and half a micron across. This is obtained by shining a low-power laser, 1 watt argon laser, on a disc that contains a photoresist material. And the laser beam is pulsed by information, and you can get 10 to the 10th pulses per second nowadays, or even better. And when the laser pulse is on, you say that's one bit of information. That means yes. And where there is no laser light, that is a no. So you put one bit of information on an area of 10 to the minus 8 square centimeters, 1 micron by 1 micron, roughly. And so you have a very dense storage of information. And then you take a CD disk and you calculate that you can put 10 to the 10th bits of information on a disk. And that is a lot of information. And if you use half the wavelengths, and people have recently succeeded in doing that, you can put four times as many bits, and then you get high-definition disks. Next slide shows you the well-known CD disk, and the next slide gives you an idea of the that's upside down, but it doesn't matter. Leave it like that. This is the Encyclopedia Britannica, has 10 to the 11 bits of information in it. And you can almost put that on one disk nowadays. 10 to the 11 bits. Next slide. Yeah. And you can read it out, and every CD player in your home has a little semiconductor laser, very low power, microwatts, to read these little dimples in your disk. And that is how you can retrieve the information you have stored. But then you can also send this information via optical fibers, which are thinner than a human hair. Of course, you have to put some material around it to lay the fibers and so on. But in principle, this information can go through optical fibers by the phenomenon of total internal reflection. And that works over distances of 10,000 kilometers. That means over distances across the oceans. And these optical fiber cables are laid down under the Atlantic and under the Pacific and under the Indian Ocean, and they are now everywhere. And the information capacity is such that you can send 10 to the 11 bits in about 1 second, anywhere in the world. And that is why in modern times we now can communicate via email anywhere, and we can dial up the World Wide Web and have access to all this information stored optically, read out optically, and transported optically. So that probably has an even larger influence on human society than the medical applications of lasers. May I have the view graph get ready? I have two view graphs at the end, but first I want to show my last slide. Next slide, please. I hope this is readable. There is a blue curve here of computer sales, semiconductor items, and the time scale is from 45 to 75. This slide was made about 30 years ago, 28 years ago. And here is the blue line is the sales of semiconductor devices. And you see, then there is this red line, which is dotted from here on, because that was the year in which the slide was made. That was the year 82. And you see, the development of the laser market is very similar to the development of the semiconductor market in this region. And then economists boldly extrapolated and said the laser market will follow roughly the same curve, and that's the dotted red line. And here we are now in for the lasers, with 17-year delay. Remember that the laser was invented roughly 17 years after the transistor, and then the laser field developed along the same financial path, 70 years delay, and here we would be for the year 2000 at about a laser market of 10 billion. And that is not very far from the truth, as I will now show. So it is a very important market. I have here the machine. That's all for the slide. Thank you very much. In fact, I didn't tell this yet, but these optical fibers under the ocean have lasers in them, built-in lasers. And you just dope a piece of this silica material with erbium. And you talk about erbium-doped fiber amplifiers. And every 10 or 100 kilometers, you have an amplifier to avoid the unavoidable losses of light scattering due to Brillouin scattering of the thermal motion of the atoms in the fiber. And an erbium-doped fiber can, in principle, transmit 1 terabit, 10 to the 12 bits of information per second over a distance of 10,000 kilometers. A terabit is 78 million telephone conversations simultaneously, or 180 high-resolution movies simultaneously over one fiber. And here is a practical system that has been operating between Western Europe and Southeast Asia for years, but it's operated by 92 international carriers belonging to 63 countries. It has only 20 gigabits per second information. We can do two orders of magnitude better now. And it can transmit, that fiber already could transmit the entire Encyclopedia Britannica to all these landing points. You know, the total cable length is 39,000 kilometers. It has 410 landing points in 63 countries. So it made our world more unified. That is the gist of that. There are higher power cables under the Atlantic between the United States and Western Europe now, and they could transmit the Encyclopedia Britannica in less than a second. And so it has made humanity connected very much closer together, thanks in part to laser technology and optical fiber technology. And here is the situation of the laser market in the year 2000. It was a total of 6.3 billion, but that didn't include the fiber optics parts, which is almost doubled that figure. And most of that 6.3 billion was for semiconductor lasers, who have a long lifetime, are very efficient, and replace the others. And materials processing I talked about would be 1.2 billion. But the more important thing is, and I have to come back to lasers in war rather than peace, less than 1 billion is for the military market. And what are the military applications that are widespread? There are two of them I want to mention. Every tank, Iraqi, German, United States, you name it, every tank has a laser rangefinder. You put out a light pulse, the light scatters back from the target. It is identified by its very precise wavelengths or frequency, and you, a detector, tells you how much the time delay there was for that light to travel back and forth between you and the target. Laser range finding. And then another one is laser target designation. A soldier on the ground shines a laser beam on what has to be hit on the target. And then the scattered light, identified by its very precise frequency, is detected by an incoming pilot or by an unmanned missile detector. And it homes in on that target, which emits a very well-defined frequency or wavelength. And now you can argue, is that good or bad war application? Well, it saved many civilian lives, because these laser-guided attacks are much more precise and prevent unnecessary civilian deaths in the neighborhood of the target. Then there is the issue, laser beams have been used and could be used to blind people. And then there is a moral discussion. Is this more immoral than shooting a person with a bullet from a gun? The bullet of the gun is more effective than the blinding by a laser beam. So there are all kinds of moral issues involved, of course, here, which I won't go into. But the main conclusion of my talk is lasers are primarily beneficial to mankind, and more than 80% of laser expenditures are for civilian purposes. Thank you.
Thank you.